Word of mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. New data shows that for nearly a decade, Americans have been driving less, especially younger drivers. With an added drop in vehicle sales and issued driver's licenses, some researchers and reporters suggest that the U.S. may have passed peak car and that the nation's love affair with driving is cooling off. Jordan Weissman is senior associate editor at The Atlantic, where he wrote about the concept of peak car. Hello, Jordan.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Also with us is Emily Badger, staff writer for The Atlantic Cities, and she's also covered the peak car phenomenon. Emily, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Virginia.
So, Jordan, first to you, the concept of peak car, can you kind of summarize it for us?
Yeah, you know, it's not the idea that we've hit kind of a maximum number of cars on the road necessarily, but it's more the idea that per American or per driver, we're getting on the road less and there are fewer cars per household. And Michael Sivak at University of Michigan, he's a researcher there. He's really pressed it in particular. And a little while ago, he came out with a report showing that cars per household, for instance, had peaked right around kind of 2006, I believe.
Emily, American driving habits are not measured only by how many miles the average driver puts on the vehicle. What are some of the other indicators that show a decline in driving?
Well, we know, for instance, that younger drivers are less likely to get their driver's licenses than their parents would have been at their age or than sort of previous generations would have been. So we have young people not as interested in learning to drive and getting their driver's licenses. We have fewer people actually registering new vehicles. We can also look at what researchers refer to as sort of vehicle miles traveled. This is the total number of miles that most of us drive sort of on average in a given year. And that data can also sort of be diced up in multiple different ways. We can look at sort of how much people are driving per household, how much people are driving per car, how much people are driving per commuter. And just about any way that you dice this data, as Jordan mentioned, these trends have been sort of heading downward. And the thing that's so interesting about these trends is that, you know, this moment that we kind of think of as potentially being peak car really kind of predates the recession.
Jordan said 2006. I mean, we heard a lot in the recession that people aren't buying cars, they're not driving as much because they're not going to work. Why do you date it to 2006? What do you guess?
Well, when we actually sort of plot all of these various trends in vehicle miles traveled and driver's licenses and auto registrations and things like that, I mean, you can literally sort of see a little kind of peak in the graph, a moment where sort of a downturn takes place. And depending on which metric we're looking at, these tend to be somewhere in between about 2004 and 2006. And the reason why that's so meaningful is that I think it would be really easy to just say the reason why people are driving less is because of the recession. It's because, you know, people are unemployed. They don't have jobs to drive through because people are trying to save money on gas. It would be fairly easy to sort of debunk the notion of peak car if it perfectly coincided with the recession, but what the data suggests is that it doesn't.
There's been a trend in the past couple of decades among urban planners and transportation experts to make public transportation more accessible inside of cities, even sort of light rail just inside of commuting cities. Has that had any effect on the amount of that people are driving?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely had an effect. I mean, public transit is a more attractive option than it was in the past. It's more reliable. Cities are investing more in it. They're more sort of unconventional kind of public transit options to people available now, like bike share. This is something that didn't exist in most cities in America even just 2 or 3 years ago, and that's sort of an alternative to driving. And we also sort of simultaneously know from kind of the urban planning point of view that where people are interested in living is changing. A lot more people are interested in living now in these neighborhoods that we call kind of walkable communities.
Mm-hmm.
You know, these are places where you don't have to have a car. And this is really kind of in stark contrast to where people were typically living 20, 30 years ago, where most families were out in suburbia where you had to have a car and drive everywhere, whether you wanted to or not.
Jordan Weissman, that's the data. But in your piece, you talk a little bit, I think, more about the psychosocial aspects of car ownership. What do you think is going on in the American cultural demographic that is changing the way that people drive?
I want to hit on the economic aspect of this, though, really briefly, which is, you know, even though the peak predates the recession, you do have to remember that from 2004 to 2006, you were seeing the beginning of the gas bubble, it's called that, when prices for oil and fuel were skyrocketing, essentially. And it's pretty well recorded that that has an impact on car sales. And then the other part of it is that by 2006, you had the beginning of the housing bust. So my take on that is not that necessarily, you know, in economics, they call trends that don't depend on the business cycle secular trends, right? You know, regardless of how good or bad the economy is. And I think that the peak car might be a secular trend. But I think it's also very possible that the recession and kind of the lead up to the recession will have been the turning point where really it went from a shift that was beginning to happen and sort of accelerated. But in terms of culture, right, a lot of attention has been focused on buying habits of Gen Y. And why? Well, A, because Gen Y is a gigantic group of consumers and our habits are going to shape the way companies sell things. And frankly, car companies are really worried about our approach to car ownership, our attachment to the idea of car ownership, and whether or not essentially smartphones and, you know, laptops are replacing sports cars or whatnot in our hearts. Gen Y was and is still being affected by the recession. Mm-hmm. It's hit us in the pocketbooks. And, you know, something like a smartphone or a computer is actually in a lot of ways almost as big a life purchase as a car used to be for some people, just because financially they're not as well off. And also, yeah, there is a sense that Gen Y doesn't want to be tied down to, you know, to a car. If you talk to people who are in the real estate business, they really believe that we're going to want to live in these, like I said, these walkable communities, these sort of urban light suburbs that are like right on the ring of a city. Mm. And to a degree, I think that becomes a little self-fulfilling because that's what gets built and marketed.
So Gen Y, also known as the millennials, these are the people who are in their 20s. Ironic that you say that they don't want to be tied down to a car because it used to be a sort of symbol of freedom. You've broken from your parents when you have your car and you can move around.
Yeah, you know, it used to be, but now I think for a lot of people, it's a symbol of car payments. You know, it's one more thing. You've got your student debt payment, you got your car loan you got to take care of, and whatever other monthly expense you have your, you know, the $100X a month you're paying for your data plan and cell phone bill. And the bottom line is you don't need a car as much to communicate with people, where you don't have to go over to people's houses and they're, you know, to hang out or whatnot. And it's easy to write that off, but there have actually been some studies about internationally showing that places where internet use increases, you actually see miles driven kind of decrease.
Would either of you care to venture a guess as to what American driving habits will look like 5 or even 10 years from now?
Well, one of the things that is so interesting to me about all of this is I think there's pretty universal agreement that it's this sort of millennial generation that Jordan mentioned that's kind of driving these trends. But this is a generation that's primarily in its 20s right now. It doesn't have children. It doesn't own homes for the most part. And we really don't actually know what this generation is going to do when they get a little bit older and they do start to have children and they decide that they're sort of less enamored with living in a tiny rental apartment in the city. I mean, I think that demographically speaking, you know, that this generation is going to enter a new life cycle in the future where they may find that, in fact, no, they would like to have cars after all. And the kind of big sort of unanswered question for me in all of this, as far as what this is going to look like in 5 or 10 years, is whether or not these trends that we're seeing on the part of millennials right now are going to change as they get older and as sort of the needs that they have in their life change.
Jordan?
Yeah, I mean, I'm always a little hesitant with, you know, you need to have a kind of a good dose of humility when it comes to guessing what's going to happen 5, 10 years out. But yeah, I mean, eventually millennials, like Emily said, are going to have kids and are going to own homes. It's not that they're never going to buy cars. My guess is you're going to see things like smaller cars. You might see car sharing become more popular in the future. But I think that if you look at the kinds of automobiles that are being marketed, it's not even that, you know, we won't be interested in, you know, the big SUVs and whatnot. It's just a lot of people won't be able to afford them. There's a sense that at least part of our generation is going to be, to a degree, permanently poorer because of the setback we've had in the job market. That has to factor into any projection about what's going to come next, you know?
Jordan Weissman, Senior Associate Editor at The Atlantic, and Emily Badger, Staff Writer for The Atlantic Cities. Thank you both for your time today.
Thanks for
sharing. Thank
you. You can read more about Peak Car. We have links at wordofmouthradio.org.
I don't want to be in the car anymore. I want to go home. I don't want to go to Wally World.
Yeah, it's been a real drag, Dad. Maybe we can try it some other time. Wally World's overrated anyway.
Word of Mouth!
From New Hampshire Public Radio, this is Word of Mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. The Splendid Splinter, Teddy Ballgame, The Kid. Ted Williams went by a few nicknames while playing for the Boston Red Sox, maybe none so fitting as the greatest hitter that ever lived. Williams was the last player in the major leagues to achieve a batting average over 400 for an entire season, which he did in 1941, his third season in the majors. Williams was obsessed with hitting, taking meticulous care of his bats, and often observed swinging or posing for a pitch, whether he had a bat in his hands or not. Off the field, the measure of Ted Williams is not so easy to take. A private man, he was moody and prone to bouts of rage. He would blow up at the press, his teammates, and his family. Williams married three times and had three children, but confided to friends that he had struck out as a husband and a father. Ben Bradley Jr., former editor and reporter for the Boston Globe, spent 10 years trying to find out exactly why Ted Williams was the way he was. Bradley interviewed more than 600 people who knew the kid, going all the way back to his childhood. And Ben Bradley Jr.'s new book is called The Kid, The Immortal Life of Ted Williams. Ben Bradley, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks very much.
A big revelation in your book, not only that Ted Williams was Mexican-American, but that he did not want that known. What part did he play in concealing his ethnicity?
Well, it was 100% his choice and his responsibility. I found this to be a terribly interesting part of the Ted Williams story. His mother was Mexican, and her parents were Mexican, and going back as far as records are kept. And Williams decided to conceal this, really, until the end of his life, because he was worried about prejudice of the day hurting his career. Prejudice, as we think about it back then, applied mostly to black baseball players. But Williams assumed that would carry over to Mexican Americans, and he said he was advised by someone we don't know to conceal this. And so he did, and he kind of disparagingly and jokingly referred to his extended family, cousins and whatnot on his mother's side as the Mexicans. And It's just a very interesting part of his growing up.
And it establishes very early in his baseball career, the game comes first, right? Even before identity or self.
Right. He was single-minded in his pursuit of excellence, whether it was baseball or fishing or being a jet fighter pilot. But baseball, of course, was number one. Although he was a natural in terms of his coordination, his strength, his timing, and his eyesight. He had tremendous eyesight. He never liked it when people attributed his greatness to just his natural attributes. He always said it was hard work as well, and that no one swung a bat as many times as he did.
And we learn a lot about his childhood in San Diego during the 20s and 30s, raised by his Mexican-born, deeply religious mother, who, to the point that you just spoke about, also may have taught him a lot about dedication to a cause. And his alcoholic father. So give us a little idea of what life was like for him and where baseball fit into that.
Well, baseball was his refuge, really. He grew up in Depression-era San Diego. His mother worked for the Salvation Army, and that was her passion. And she was out until all hours of the night saving souls. And Williams and his younger brother Danny were some of the original latchkey kids because their mother wasn't home to cook them dinner or to really put them to bed or anything until 10, 11 o'clock at night. So they would be waiting for her on the front step, and Ted would be down on the playground. Luckily for him, it was only a block or two away, and they had lights. So he would play baseball all day and into the night. And the father was not much of an influence. He was sort of an alcoholic and a ne'er-do-well. Ran a little downtown photo shop to no great effect, and ran off with his secretary and left the family. So Ted had a troubled upbringing.
You do describe him playing at North Park near his house, and Rod Luscombe following this man around, one of several surrogate fathers that he sort of picked up through the way. He made his way into the pros with the San Diego Padres, then into the majors with the Red Sox. Now, you paint this picture of him as this eager, disciplined, you know, gangly, sometimes bizarrely loud-mouthed boy man, I guess, living out his dream. And any stories come to mind about those early days with the pros?
Yeah, he had these bizarre screams that he would say. One was "Tawandatido" or something, and no one knew
what the heck?
No one knew what that meant. And hitting was the part of the game that he cared most about. He didn't care about fielding, and when he was out on the field, it was just biding time, waiting his turn to hit. And he would do shadow hitting, you know, taking his glove and just swinging it, or sometimes turn his back even to the game, and the infielders would have to yell out to him to pay attention. And sometimes when a fly ball was hit his way, for his own amusement, he would slap his thigh with the glove and yell, "Hi-o, Silver," and go chase the ball.
Well, despite those eccentricities, he did get signed to the Red Sox. Shortly afterwards, Fenway Park was altered on his insistence, specifically right field. What happened there, Ben Bradley?
Well, after his rookie year, which was stellar in all respects, he was complaining to the writers, sports writers of the day, that he could hit so many more home runs if his home field wasn't Fenway Park. Mm. It's still a very deep right field today, but back then it was even deeper, about 400 feet from home plate out to the right field fence. And, of course, Williams was a left-handed hitter and a pull hitter, so right field was the natural destination for the balls that he hit. And he got to complaining about how far the fences were and he might do better in another if he didn't have to play half his games at Fenway. And so Tom Yawkey, ever attentive, he was the owner at the time, ever attentive to Ted, decided to bring the fences in 20 feet. Mm. And so this new area, the press of the day, the Boston press, called it Williamsburg. That would be the place that all the home runs would go.
Once he became a pro, Williams did have to start dealing with the press, a pretty antagonistic relationship with them. He collectively called them the Knights of the Keyboard. How would you characterize that relationship, and what really started that feud?
Well, it was a very contentious relationship, and I think it was rooted in the fact that Williams was a perfectionist, and he thought that he was the master of his craft. And he wasn't good at accepting any criticism, whether it come from the fans or the writers, whom he was basically contemptuous of. You know, he rationalized that he could turn on a fastball and the writers couldn't. He thought of them as prying into his life, troublemakers. He didn't accept the fact that people would be interested in his life, and he guarded his privacy, fiercely.
We're speaking with Ben Bradley Jr., author of the new book called The Kid, The Immortal Life of Ted Williams. It's a deeply researched and meticulous look at the life of Ted Williams, both on and off the field. Well, now, Ben, we're speaking to a part of Williams' personality that much was made of, a troubled man unable to control his anger, rage, really. You speak to teammates and friends and family members, all talk about repeatedly watching him ignite at sometimes very, very slight provocation. Why? Any clues that you'd like to share with us about what was behind that rage?
Well, I think it mostly stemmed from his childhood and the resentment of his mother.
What, she was embarrassing to him because of
embarrassing, her? Yeah. Very embarrassing, ashamed of his childhood. Mm-hmm. He was always ashamed of the way he grew up, a wrong side of the track kid who didn't have a lot of the polish or education. He was a high school graduate and very bright, actually, with a curious mind, but always ashamed of his lack of formal education, to the point where in 1991 he turned down Harvard when they wanted to give him an honorary degree, feeling that he would be out of place amidst the intelligentsia of Harvard Yard. But he was able to channel this anger, as I suggested earlier, effectively on the field. He used it as a motivator to perform well.
So it worked for him on some level.
It worked for him on the field, but it caused him numerous immeasurable difficulty in his private life.
Well, most people do sort of dismiss it as Ted being Ted and gave him a pass because he's heroic on some level. Did he recognize himself that he had a problem with anger?
Yes, he did. And he really appreciated those who stayed with him through the storms. The price of being in Ted's orbit was that you had to accept these squalls, these storms, his rage that would suddenly bubble up. And so he went through three marriages very quickly. He had difficulty as a father. But those who stayed loyal to him, he loved them forever.
Very early in your book, we get this shockingly, to me, detailed description of the process of cryonically freezing the head of Ted Williams, which to me reinforced what a bizarre and ignoble end it was to a man who did want to be immortal. I'm curious as why you started there, Ben Bradley Jr.
Well, I thought it was a grabber, didn't you?
It certainly was.
I didn't want to start it in a conventional way that, you know, he was born in 1918, raised in San Diego, etc. And I think this is the cryonics affair was shocking to a lot of people, and it may be the last memory that they have of Williams. So I thought it was appropriate to start there and then go back into the more conventional approach to his life and then end there as well.
Other things that we learn about Ted Williams that I certainly didn't know was that he was among the first major leaguers to publicly advocate for breaking baseball's color line, wholeheartedly supporting Jackie Robinson and other players of color that came after him, pushing for the Negro League players to be admitted into the Hall of Fame. Now, you said earlier that he downplayed his own ethnicity for fear of prejudice. Do you see these two things as connected?
Well, it's interesting. He may have been certainly more aware of the plight of black players because of his own immigrant background. That was a stellar moment for him, which really wasn't recognized at the time. Nobody made anything of it, which was a bit surprising. But this happened in 1966 when he was being inducted into the Hall of Fame. And during his acceptance speech at Cooperstown, he called on the lords of Cooperstown to admit the old Negro League players into the Hall of Fame.
And I hope that someday the names of Satchel Paige and Josh Gibson in some way can be added as a symbol of the great Negro players that are not here only because they were not given a chance.
So it was a very unusual thing for a player to do. He was retired by then, but still, ball players aren't political. And so Williams gets a lot of credit for that.
Before his more antagonistic relationship with the press, after that early 1941 record-setting season, he did tell a sports writer that he wanted to be immortal. So here he is in your book, you know, immortalized in really great depth and detail, warts and all. What are you carrying away as your impression of Ted Williams after writing this book?
Well, I think that he, above all, is a perfectionist who strove for excellence in everything that he did. He had limited patience for people who didn't try their best, who didn't try to excel on the level that he did. He was a troubled man who wanted fame but not the inconvenience of celebrity. And yet, ultimately, I think this is a redemptive story, because the anger was leavened by a fundamental kindness, as evidenced mostly by the work that he did on behalf of sick kids with cancer, insisting on visiting them at all hours of the day and night, but privately with no press, and helping others who were down on their luck and hurting. you know, like old ball players who didn't have any money. Mm. And he would call them up and say he was raising money for the Jimmy Fund, and the guy would hem and haw and say, "Geez, Ted, I'm hurting for money. I can't give you anything." And he said, "God damn it, this is Ted Williams. I'm asking you. Send me a check for $10. So the guy would send him a check for $10, and he would take the numbers down off the checking account and wire the fellow $1,000 anonymously. Mm. That kind of generosity. So he was a troubled guy, but also a fundamentally kind and decent person, too.
Ben Bradley Jr., thank you for that window into the kid. Appreciate your time today.
Thank you so much.
Ben Bradley Jr., formerly editor and reporter for the Boston Globe, where he spent 25 years. His new book is called The Kid, The Immortal Life of Ted Williams. You can find much more on the book and see video of that beautiful Ted Williams swing over at wordofmouthradio.org.
It's a shame, 'cause it's 1, 2, 3 strikes you out at the old ball game.
And now for an underground holiday debate from the pop culture sphere. Is Die Hard a Christmas movie? May not be warm and fuzzy, but the Bruce Willis blockbuster has appealed to many as an alternative Christmas favorite since its release in 1988. The classification, however, has not gone unchallenged. Bill Barry has the story.
To many, any best of action film list would ring hollow, with the exclusion of Die Hard.
Got invited to the Christmas party by mistake. Who knew?
Every year, though, as the holiday season approaches, Die Hard begins to fly under a different flag. Kevin Noonan of The Observer calls it a Christmas classic disguised as an action thriller, and he's not alone. Just listen to Die Hard fan Kevin Flynn.
What doesn't say Christmas like a terrorist plot foiled by Bruce Willis?
Now I have a machine gun.
Film analyst Garen Daly contributes a more academic theory.
It's been talked about ever since the film came out, because it takes a Christmas theme and turns it into an action, violent film. There are a lot of films that families use these days as traditional family films at Christmas time that would not necessarily be called Christmas films.
Garen submits that non-traditional Christmas films expose what family and Christmas is all about, though in a slightly twisted fashion. Die Hard, upon deconstruction, is an alternative tale about a family coming together.
Why don't we make it easy? I have a spare bedroom. Kids would love to have you at the house.
They would, huh?
I would, too.
Both Forbes and Empire magazine list Die Hard number one on their lists of top all-time Christmas films, with Forbes describing it as everything a Christmas movie should always be forever. But not everyone is on board. Sam Todd of the student paper Impact Nottingham refuses to lump Die Hard in with such Christmas classics as It's a Wonderful Life.
Look, Daddy, teacher says every time a bell rings, an angel gets his wings.
I think you have to make a distinction between a movie set at Christmas, like Die Hard, and a Christmas movie. A Christmas movie is so much more about the feeling and the atmosphere rather than its setting.
Sam defines Die Hard as a cold film, polar opposite in feeling than the traditional Christmas films of yore.
It could be a victim of the sort of 80s aesthetic. The Nakatomi Plaza, it's bare and it's unfinished. It's not a warm Christmas setting, and as well as that, you also have poor Al and Argyle, who are stuck working on Christmas Eve.
Come out to the coast, we'll get together, have a few laughs.
Leon Thomas of GuyWithTheGlasses.com presents an objective methodology, breaking the Christmas movie definition down to 5 questions.
1. Does it take place around Christmas? 2. Do we learn something about the Christmas spirit? 3. Are there any visual or audio references to Christmas, like seeing elves or hearing jingle bells? 4. Is the Christmas element absolutely essential to the plot? And 5. Do people watch this movie around Christmas?
Leon says the results come out to a tie, though he finds tie-breaking wisdom in a familiar tune.
And if Winter Wonderland can be a Christmas song with no Christmas lyrics, then Die Hard is without a doubt a Christmas movie, even though it is mainly about non-Christmas themes and events.
While movie bloggers and critics might not totally agree, what might matter most is what the fans think. When the holidays come around, do you find yourself surrounded by family, fires, feasts, and a hearty serving of Die Hard?
It's Christmas, Theo. It's the time of miracles, so be of good cheer.
For superfans like Kevin Flynn, the answer is simple.
As Argyle said, if this is how they spend Christmas, I gotta be here for New Year.
For Word of Mouth, I'm Bill Barry.
Okay, then, how about you? Is Die Hard Christmassy enough for your holiday playlist? You can join the debate. It's already in progress on our Facebook page, Word of Mouth Radio.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Sweet dreams are made of tears. Who am I to disagree? I travel the world.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, this is Word of Mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. Making your dreams come true is a pursuit best accomplished while awake. Altering the nature of your dreams, argues Stephen LaBerge, can be done in your sleep. Since the 1970s, LaBerge has been studying lucid dreaming, the phenomenon of being aware that you are dreaming while remaining asleep. LaBerge conducts workshops to teach people how to jump into that state and rewrite the dream script. After years spent on the fringes of mainstream science, lucid dream research is gaining momentum in studies of brain function. Dorian Ralston is a freelance writer who covers cognitive science, mental health, and the mind. He attended one of LaBerge's workshops and wrote about the experience and the study of lucid dreaming for the online publication Matter. Hello, Dorian.
Hi, Virginia.
Anything you'd like to add to that brief sketch of lucid dreaming?
Well, the definition is quite straightforward, but it's subtle. Lucid dreaming is simply being aware that you're dreaming while you're dreaming. You're not creating a dream from scratch. The dream's going on. You become aware that you're dreaming or become lucid, and then it's a matter of cultivating the ability to redirect the plot as you like. And it's not an easy skill to learn, and when people begin cultivating it, they might try flying, or they might try to engage in kind of erotic fantasies or do things that just normally aren't part of their waking life. Some people report even healing psychological wounds, confronting recurrent nightmare characters, even practicing skills. Some athletes or musicians might rehearse certain practices in their dream that a few have actually reported have resulted in real gains in waking life.
Given what we now know or can study about brain science, do we know what is happening in the brain when a person is lucid dreaming?
One thing that we've found is that the frontal lobes appear to be activated the moment that someone becomes lucid in a dream. And these frontal areas of the brain are typically associated with executive functions, such as long-term planning, memory, even self-reflection, which coheres with the way lucid dreamers report the experience. And the way we're able to do this science now is really a methodology that goes back to the late 1970s, Stephen LaBerge doing his graduate work at Stanford.
Tell us about this Stephen LaBerge, the man you describe as the founding father of lucid dreaming.
So Stephen LaBerge was the first sleep scientist to publish empirical proof of a lucid dream. And what he was doing at Stanford in the late 1970s was utilizing a recent discovery of his advisor, William Dement, about rapid eye movements. Rapid eye movements had been known to be associated with the most vivid moments of dreaming during the night. So his advisor, William Dement, discovered that these eye movements weren't always random. Sometimes they actually conformed to the content of the dream. For example, he noticed in one case, eye movements were shifting left, right, left, right, left, right. And he thought that the pattern was too deliberate to be completely random. So he woke the subject up, asked the subject what they were dreaming about, and lo and behold, they reported dreaming about a ping pong match. So LaBerge figured that if these involuntary eye movements can form to the content of an ordinary dream, then voluntary eye movements could conform to the content of a lucid dream in which you gain control over the dream. So he took himself as the first subject and went to sleep in the lab, tethered to all this polysomnographic equipment, measuring the electrical activity given off by his eyes and his brain and other muscles throughout his body. And in the early morning hours, there was a very definitive sign on the recording equipment that he was signaling to his lab technician that he had awakened in his dream.
Yet LaBerge himself is still considered a fringy character. Why is that?
Well, for one thing, he didn't pursue a conventional tenure track. He published his seminal study discovering that lucid dreamers could be empirically verified. And he struggled a lot to convince his colleagues not only that this was a real phenomenon, but also that it was a phenomenon worthy of study. At the time, sleep science was changing paths and funding was being diverted to clinical studies rather than so-called pure research on states of consciousness. And LaBerge didn't want to compromise his interest, so he found another way to continue studying lucid dreaming, which was to hold these workshops, which would fund his research privately and would also generate experimental subjects in the form of attendees at these workshops, of which I was one this past September.
And what did you walk away thinking, that this is genuine science or a little bit more mystical?
I think the peer-reviewed science on lucid dreaming is genuine. I think it's illuminating interesting things about consciousness. I think it's still a very new science. I mean, this is only in the past 5 years that a lot of these insights have come to light. So it'll take replication. It'll take a number of years and certainly more subjects. Right now, we only have a handful of lucid dreams as our data points from which to draw these conclusions. So it'll take some time to corroborate these findings. But as far as the peer-reviewed literature is concerned, I'm convinced that it's significant and certainly rigorous. As far as what LaBerge is doing in Hawaii, it's difficult to say. He claims that he's amassed reams of data over decades of running these workshops with hundreds of data points of lucid dreams that have happened in Hawaii or before that when he ran the workshops on Stanford's campus. But none of it has been analyzed and certainly none of it has been published. So it's difficult to say exactly what we're going to learn from that data that he's gathered. But he promises that it's going to overturn some of these new findings that are coming to light now. But we'll have to wait and see.
Dorian, are you still trying to practice lucid dreaming?
I certainly am. I think now that I'm returning to a regular sleep schedule, not being quite so pressed on deadline, I'm going to devote myself a little more to seeing how far I can cultivate this skill. I don't think I'm one of the naturally prodigious lucid dreamers, as LaBerge or others seem to be. Some of the folks that I've spoken to really are able to concoct quite elaborate, vivid scenarios in their dreams that I only get the chance to see in the movies.
Well, Dorian, thank you for speaking with us today.
All right. Thank you so much, Virginia.
Dorian Rolston writes about cognitive science and mental health in the mind for publications like The New Yorker, The Atlantic, and The Paris Review. You can link to read his article about lucid dreaming for the online publication Matter at wordofmouthradio.org.
Have you ever had a dream, Neo, that you were so sure was real?
Let me ask you a question. You never really remember the beginning of a dream, do you? You always wind up right in the middle of what's going on.
I guess, yeah.
So how did we end up here?
Well, we just came from the,
Think about it, Ariadne. How did you get here? Where are you right now?
People living with dementia can appear to live in their own world, a complicated, non-linear inner world not so easily communicated to or understood by others. There are few tools to help ease the isolation experienced by many with the syndrome. The London-based writer Susanna Howard is attempting to give people with dementia a voice, visiting them and recording their words as poetry.
Comments on language and words. Sometimes you don't feel on top of the world. You think, I wish something like this or that happened, I could remember better. The whole life is a mystery. We can't assume what we can assume will happen to us, but we can't force it to happen. Every year that you are growing up puts different words into your mind. We are changing for the worse or the better. Sometimes you don't feel on top. The point is, when you are talking about one thing, your mind is going in different directions. Yes, sometimes in conversation you use words that weren't intentional, but they fit. We got to be a gold mine practically of words, can stir something else up. Think, wish, remember.
Susanna is artistic director of Living Words. It's an arts and literature program helping people with dementia feel understood and heard, even when communication may seem lost. Susanna, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Lovely. It's fantastic to talk to you.
How did you get the idea for Living Words?
Well, I went through a personal experience of really losing myself, actually, and was going through a lot of internal pain and conflict and didn't want to sort of seek any sort of medical help for this. And so I sat and I did have some time, which was a real privilege, and I had paper and pen and I just wrote and I wrote and was just sort of getting everything out of me. And through that process, I was able to begin to find myself again. And then I thought, well, this gives an opportunity here in working with other people. And I found out that there were arts organisations that were linked to hospitals that would support perhaps this kind of work. So I pitched this idea and they said to me, we like your intention, but we only have money for the elderly care unit and for people with dementia. I said, okay. And it suddenly started, things started to click together. I just came out just knowing that this was the right path for me. That first placement, there was a woman there who I worked with, and she really taught me a lot, and she had advanced dementia. And when we finished working together, she looked into my eyes and she said, now you know two worlds. The one outside and the one inside in me, and you've got to go and tell all the people. I've held that and kept that as my mission.
Well, I'd love you to talk to us a little bit more about that process of assembling poems for a patient. First of all, you find them mostly in care homes or caregiving situations there in the UK. Is there much editing or input, or you just talk to them and you just record exactly as it is?
Well, it's a real technique that I've developed over the time. We work one-on-one with residents, and we sit. Really important part of the process is being able to sit in silence and just be together. And we use eye contact, connecting through the eyes. And really, I like people who do the work to be able to have their own meditation practice, because that can quiet the noise that we can sometimes have in our head. And let me tell you, people with Alzheimer's and dementia know if you're not focusing on them and know if there's something going on or if you're palming them off. So we just sit together, and sometimes we sit for a long time in silence. I have my paper and pen, or whoever's doing it has their paper and pen, and that's really a bridge between us. When they speak, the person sees me writing their words down, and it's sort of an act that happens between us. And I have the recorder as well, and the recorder is just there so that we can go back and check that everything is correct, because we don't want to be putting words in people's mouths. So we write the words down, and then we edit it by taking things out, but we don't change the meaning or the way they came together. We might put themes together, perhaps. Sometimes you can think, gosh, if there was an extra word here that they hadn't said, this would really be profound, or really, you know, this would clearly get what they're saying across, but we'd never do that.
Let's hear just a little bit more of some of the work of Living Words, a collaboration between Susanna Howard, who we're speaking to today, and a number of different patients with dementia.
Number 65. This chair, it's so dirty feeling. I'm not in running order. Where do you go to when you go out? I keep out of walking mode with the mainframe in the convoy. Don't go around much. I wish I could drive in a big car. Drive away in a car. Oh, I I wish I could fly right away to number 65, not drifting along at nothing.
You are releasing these poems, you know, to the world as creative works. And I suppose, you know, poetry is not required to make sense in the same way that we expect from prose. I mean, what is it about poetry and creative writing that helps people with dementia, do you think?
Well, I think perhaps there's another angle of coming at it. There's lots of people that I'm working with are more advanced in their dementia, which is that their experience in their brain and their mind is an expression that is used a lot. It's moving from your head to your heart. In terms of the brain, you're sort of moving from your left side to your right side more. There's more free space there because we live in a society where we're made to sort of organise and be logistical a lot of the time. I feel that the words that need to be said just come up, and they may happen to be metaphorical. Someone may be searching for something and they say an alternate word, but it doesn't mean that it doesn't make sense. It means that it perfectly describes what they're trying to say.
Mm-hmm. Do you see changes or improvement in patients after working with them?
Yes, you can. And I think we need to be able to communicate with each other. And I think that sometimes for the care industry, it's not the best thing to have lots of people who have dementia being able to express themselves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, what's the line there?
It's a line between money and, you know, what we could say, you know, what is right for people. But it's going to cost more, you could say. That's the thinking. But the reality is that talking and communicating and not feeling that sense of isolation, that feeling utterly depressed. If I was to stay in some care homes that I've worked in, I'm sure within a month I would certainly be clinically depressed and I would be displaying the signs of dementia. The reality is it's a lot cheaper to have people doing arts work than it is for them to be taking pills. I mean, I can't talk money or anything like that, but it's something that in this country is being talked about a lot. Because what you're not just looking at the medicine, what you're looking at is if someone's engaged and feeling not so isolated, then they're not going to have as many falls necessarily. They're not going to have as many admissions into hospitals.
How do the people that you work with react when you read their poems back to them?
Well, with Living Words, what we do is we have the poems put into books for every individual. They have their Living Words books. Even if they've just said one word over all our time together, they have their book. And then that book is a bridge between the carer and their relative and the person, because we really don't want the work to just be a flying in and flying out. We want to help people be continuing their communication. We work with staff on that. But how do people react when I read their words back to them? They say, yes, yes. Some people shout out. Some people are saying the words along. Some people take a long time to respond. Then they say, oh, there's a man I worked with who took 10 minutes to respond every time. And his words, after I'd read his poem out, was, it's a call to arms, like positive action. And a woman most recently said to me, and you don't want to overstate things, but she said, you doing this, writing my words and reading them back to me, it's like medicine for me.
Mm, well, a big yes and thanks to you for joining us, Susanna.
Thank you.
Susanna Howard, London-based writer, artistic director of Living Words. She takes the words of people living with dementia and turns them into poetry. You can read some of them at wordofmouthradio.org and learn more about Living Words there. Thank you for spending some time with us today. We do invite you to share what you heard with others. You can go to wordofmouthradio.org for a deep catalog of conversations to listen to post on social media, or to email on to your friends. And let us know what you're curious about, the stories or the sources that you find interesting or that stick in your head. What is scratching at that sense of wonder in you? We find that the best stories tend to bounce around by word of mouth. Let's keep on sharing them. I'm Virginia Prescott. Until next time, this is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by
Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
Bill Berry,
and Zach Nugent.
Our intern is
James Pouliot.
Digital support from Rebecca Lavoie
and Sarah Plord.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. To subscribe to our podcast and listen to past shows,
go to wordofmouthradio.org.
You can also join us on Facebook and Tumblr at Word of Mouth Radio.
Follow us on Twitter at Word of Mouth.
And check out a playlist of music from the program on Spotify.
Word of Mouth
is a production
of New Hampshire Public Radio.